You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Today we are on the Collao Fanguaya.
Good evening, buenas tardes from La Vuelta a España. My name is Daniel Freiba. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast from La Vuelta. You heard our friend Rob Hatch just say that I am on the Collao Fanguaya, the scene of today's stage finish, stage 8 of the Vuelta a España. Not strictly true, because for logistical reasons, I'm unsure about the network coverage up there. I stayed down at the bottom of the climb in a little village. Dan, I've just given away who our guest is this evening. It's called Entre la Puente, and well, I will get to the identity of our guest this evening. Joining me from La Massana in Andorra, it's two-time Vuelta a España stage winner, two-time Tour de France stage winner, Giro d'Italia stage winner, Liège-Bastogne-Liège winner, Il Lombardia winner, soon to be acclaimed author, cycling's most decorated podcaster, and we established the other day, owner of the best wine cellar of any cycling podcast guest, with the exception probably of Brian Nygaard. It's Dan Martin, or as we know him here, Dan Martin. Dan, how are you?
Your pronunciation cracks me. But yeah, good, and excited to actually talk about mountain stage this time.
It was a cracker, wasn't it? I mean, we didn't see all of it. We missed a fairly key couple of kilometres there when the TV pictures cut out. I was slightly worried we were going to be talking about the Phantom J Vine yet again, because having won one stage that we didn't really see, well, we didn't really see him crossing the line with his arms aloft, we thought we were going to miss it all again, but that wasn't the case. But it was a fantastic stage, wasn't it?
It was just typical of Vuelta, and in that region as well. It's such a beautiful region, technical roads. Obviously, the riders got really lucky today, because I think that rain was actually forecast, and on those descents, it just makes it more tricky. And then you've got that goat track up to the finish line. It's typical of Vuelta.
Are you a fan, Dan, of the Cuestas de Cabras, these goat paths that we've had traditionally in the Vuelta a España? And we haven't got quite as many of them this year, but I think today's did qualify.
Yeah, I don't know where they find them. I mean, every year they seem to, I don't think they finished up there before, and every year they just seem to they obviously send the scouts out to find these roads, and yeah, it just adds a little flavour. It means that nobody's done any recon, right? Or very few riders have got the time during the season to actually recon these climbs, and it just adds in that unknown. And it although obviously, yeah, with the, it looks like they had a power cut at the finish, the organizers, and with the motorbikes getting up there, the cars, the vehicles, it's a bit tricky, but it does add something. It just makes the Vuelta what it is.
Well, we have talked in the past actually, Dan, about how in Spain there is a bit of there's been a thriving community, particularly of on the online forums, who have sort of corralled and pulled suggestions for climbs using the Vuelta, and they've passed these on to the Vuelta organization, and the Vuelta organization has been quite receptive in the past, and that has been a good source of these goat tracks, as we said. And we'll hear later, in fact, when we talk about tomorrow's stage, about how Javier Guillen, the race director, discovered tomorrow's stage finish at a cider festival. But enough chit-chat, Dan. Your first real task of this evening is going to be the stage summary time trial. So take it away, Rob Hatch.
El resumen del día a contrarreloj. The stage summary time trial.
Dan, are you ready? Are you feeling confident for the resumen de la etapa a contrarreloj?
I think I got a feeling for it on last weekend, so yeah, we'll give it a crack.
There's a lot to talk about, Dan. These tend to get, well, the old tail of the tapper and the new feature that's replaced it, they get difficult when we get to the mountain. So I'm going to wish you best of luck, and I'm going to start the stopwatch. You have 90 seconds, Dan Martin, from now.
Right, so typical Vuelta stage, Asturias, beautiful scenery, brutal start. A lot of sprinters would have been terrified of the start today, and I'm not even sure if they all made it home, but haven't seen the results yet, but they're probably still out there. 3,700 metres climbing, up and down all day, nowhere to rest, nowhere to hide on those technical downhills. Two races, breakaway and peloton. GC guys. Once the break had gone, things calmed down. Very strong group. Looked like they were always going to go for the stage, but they seemed to have to work hard at it all day, as the peloton didn't seem that interested in giving them a big time gap due to the GC guys involved up front. Other than that, all came down to the last climb, which we didn't see much of because it's a goat track and they had a power course at the top. Very narrow little climb, very steep, typical Jay Vine, unbelievable ride. Two stage victories now. Made his attack, was clearly the strongest when he attacked. He didn't even need to attack, he just rode off the front, basically, away from a group of really strong climbers with Lutsenko, Pino, Marc Soler, all in good condition, and he just made, like, Jay Vine just rode away from them. GC battle, Quickstep had it in control. They really put their stamp on the race today. Remco looked like what was, yeah, really in control, rode his tempo.
10 seconds down,
which was too strong for the majority of the GC guys. And status quo for the top three or four, but bigger gaps appearing behind.
Well, that was, you sped up very well towards the end there. That was Roglic-esque, although, well, we didn't see the trademark Roglic sprint at the end of today's stage. He actually came across, well, third in his little group that detached itself with Remco and Enric Mas, and he was just behind. But just on the GC, Dan, excellent job, by the way, outstanding, getting better and better with every appearance, and even the debut appearance was very good. But on the GC, Remco Evenepoel still leads. Enric Mas 28 seconds down. Primoz Roglic 1 minute, 1 second down. No real change there. But Carlos Rodriguez has moved up four places. He's now fourth on GC. Teo Gegenhardt, his Ineos teammate, fifth on GC. Juan Ayuso sixth, 2 minutes, 2 seconds down. Simon Yates seventh. Joao Almeida eighth. Jai Hindley ninth. Ben O'Connor 10th. There's a lot of movement today, Dan, and well, we'll get to who were the winners and who were the losers later in the episode in part two. But I also, well, haven't done this for the last couple of days, forgotten, but we do ask our guests to give the stage a wine glass rating out of five. Entertainment value today, Dan, how was it? Was it a tippy-tappy Beaujolais, or was it a nice, robust Ribera del Duero?
I think you overplayed my wide knowledge. I think
wow, give it a mark out of five, Dan.
Yeah, a mark out of five. I think it was, I was quite disappointed, actually. I think it was quite maybe a three. I think the nature of the stage, everybody's a little bit scared for tomorrow, so it definitely tempered the aggression a little bit, but also we didn't see the part that we wanted to see when Remco dropped everybody again. So we don't even know if it was Remco that dropped everybody or somebody else attacking. So, yes, I think it was a great stage, but when you have two stages back-to-back, it always makes guys be a little bit more calm.
I think it was an above-average mountain stage. I'm going to give it a four, but my evaluation doesn't really matter. It's the guest that counts the most. It's the guest that gets the big bucks, isn't that right, Dan? We'll talk about money later. We'll talk about people receiving handsome rewards for their performances very shortly, in fact. But first, let's hear from a couple of the protagonists on today's stage. So now we'll hear from Teo Gegenhardt and Remco Evenepoel.
Yeah, I think what the team showed today is something that we never could show. So we've been riding very defensively, in defense mode, but we just had to control the breakaway. It was a bit special because Lambda was in, so we just didn't want to let it grow more than 4 minutes. So the guys did a perfect job in the valleys and on the first smaller climbs. So I think what we showed today is what a real GC team stands for. Yeah, well, like I said to the guys, look, we put a hard pace at the bottom because also the first 3K were like the least hard. I mean, we're not as hard as the final 3-4 kilometers. So we just wanted to put a good pace, but not overpace ourselves because we knew that the steepest parts were coming. And that's where Ilan took over. That was the plan, that he had to pace on the steepest part. And then we said, okay, look, Remco, if you have the legs, you just go for the last 4K on your own and you do your own race. But then Theo took over and it was like a real attack. I mean, it was like 500-600 watts for a couple of seconds, maybe a minute. So that was a real attack. And that's actually the point that I decided, okay, I'm just going to put the pressure on the pedals, keep pushing. And that's where the race completely exploded.
Really, really humid. And yeah, very slippery into the climb. And the twisty road was super slippery, but yeah, we just have to find the balance between being patient and your flies are undone. And yeah, using the team well, but not wasting them. We have such a strong team here, so yeah, we don't have the best riders, so it's not for us to like really impose ourselves on the race. We just had to pick our moments and be smart, and it was really slippery and a bit rubbish, and we tried to sit second team for a bit, but it was worse, to be honest, because you never take the good line. So the last bit we decided to just squeeze a little bit, and then yeah, I don't know, it was a good day for Carlos, and I hope I'll keep getting better as the race goes on, and stay out of trouble, stay healthy, not crash, all those things, and see what happens. Now, for me, to be honest, if I'm healthy, then my experience of the Grand Tours I've done is, like, for me personally, it gets, there isn't really a word to describe it, but my level doesn't, well, when I've been good, it hasn't changed. So that's what I have to aim for. And, yeah, I mean, you just, like I say, have to stay healthy and just keep being smart and use your energy when it matters, and save your legs when you can. Yeah, I don't know, it's strange, you just kind of get to a level, and for me, I seem to stay there, and certainly I would much prefer to do a day like this 100 times than any of the first 6 stages or 5 stages.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Vuelta España, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. Super Sapiens was founded by Phil Sutherland, a former rider who also founded the team that is now Novo Nordisk. And all of the riders on that team are type 1 diabetics. And so monitoring their glucose levels continuously is a really critical fact of life, not just a key indicator of their performance on the bike. Over the next few episodes of our Vuelta coverage, we're going to hear from a rider on the Novo Nordisk team, Sam Brand from the Isle of Man. And recently he was at the Tour of Poland for Novo Nordisk, and on day one he got into the break.
Oh, well, what an experience. You know, I think last time I did Tour of Poland on stage one, I was in the breakaway as well. So, and coming into this race, I was feeling good. I had good legs, you know, I had a lot coming up, so I really wanted to show that. And I'm the sort of person who thrives from sort of that extra level of motivation being a world tour race. So I just put the power down and jumped across the break as it started to form. And it was a fantastic day, you know, showing the team Novo Nordisk jersey, showing what's possible, and driving change and diabetes at the front of a world tour race was just an experience like no other. It's incredible. Still grinning year to year talking about stuff like this, you know, because it was a big day out, and it supported our team, our cause, and it was just a fantastic day. So it was a long stage. I think it was 220k stage. So I was off the front for about 200-205 kilometers. So from kilometer zero all the way till the sort of the last sort of, I think we got caught with maybe 12k to go.
We'll hear more from Sam tomorrow. To find out more about Super Sapiens, go to supersapiens.com.
Well, Dan, not a surprise victory for Jay Vine, in the sense that, well, he proved the other day how well he was climbing. He won the other day from the GC group, in fact. And, well, he's an emerging power in Grand Tours, isn't he? We saw last year, without much experience, he was already getting close to winning stages, had a third place, and impressed us greatly on other occasions at the Vuelta a España. And, you know, when he got away in that group of really good climbers today, I don't know about you, Dan, but I said to myself, straight away that it was going to be very difficult for the peloton to pull those boys back, because there were so many good climbers in there, Landa, Pino, Taramai, and so on and so on.
I think if you didn't have the Pino's teammates in there from FDJ, they was it Reichenbach and Amarals, and they really pushed the pace on all day. And without them riding, obviously, I think they underestimated Jay Vine again, which is strange after the other day, because it's the only, otherwise, I'm sure they would have attacked him before the final climb. It's strange that they basically gave an armchair ride to the finish and gifted him essentially the stage victory. So they're obviously very confident in Thibaut Pinot, but after Jay's performance the other day, yeah, you would have had it written, especially a finish like today when it's all about power, strength. And right, he learned to suffer on Swift, right? It's kind of, he could definitely put out a steady power, and that strength just, yeah, winning the stage again today.
Well done. This morning in La Pola Javiana, I did speak to Jay Vine in anticipation, well, that he was going to have another good day, and I thought the profile suited him today. And, well, I was keen to hear, first of all, whether his life has changed and how it's changed in the last 2 days since he became a Grand Tour winner. So let's hear from Jay Vine this morning, bearing in mind what came later on in the afternoon. Here he is.
Well, Jay, what's the best thing about being a Grand Tour stage winner based on the last couple of days?
The bonus that comes with it.
You can't say that.
Well, if you're on minimum wage, then yes, you can. Yeah, like my wife says that, oh, yeah, we celebrate every win, but our celebrations are we go for a €4 coffee. Like, cycling at the lowest levels isn't, like, as glamorous as people say. People think my net worth is, like, multiple millions of euros. It's probably a minute fraction of that in reality. So, yeah, it makes life a little bit more livable for my wife and I, especially since we're looking at starting a family as well. So,
I mean, people see it going that way, though, for you. I mean, they see you on a fast track to the very top of the sport.
I mean, that'd be amazing. My dreams are definitely to be able to do that in a GC position in the future, sort of like a practice run, if you will. But the main goal was to come into this and not focus on GC from the start. You know, we were going to lose a lot of time in the time trial, and we knew that the sprints in Netherlands were one of our opportunities to get some results with Tim, and my going for GC just confused a lot of those issues. So, you know, we decided that, you know, that we're focused on the stage win. It came from the GC group. That wasn't the plan, but we're happy it happened.
I was about to say, the fact that it came from the GC group, this wasn't a break. I mean, last year in the World Tour, you came close from a break a couple of times. But is that a light bulb for you in terms of your confidence?
Yeah, I think it is. I think the way we're riding as a team as well, we're not defending, you know, I think 36th or something on GC anymore. We're riding as like a true stage hunter type gig at the moment, until stage 11 when Tim can get his next shot at a sprint. But yeah, I think the way the team is sort of come together around this result, it's pretty special.
And just lastly, Jay, I mean, a lot was made last year of your inexperience, probably unfairly, probably, you know, when you had your crash into the team car, people said, well, of course. But how much has that improved over the last year? I mean, compared to where you were a year ago in terms of bike handling and so on, where are you?
I mean, the bike handling is probably basically the same. It's more just the experience of being in the bunch more and more and more. Like last year when I crashed into the car, I think that was my 22nd day on the road in Europe. Like, I'd raced outside before, I'd raced amateurs in Australia, I'd raced UCI in Australia, but that was my 24th or something day in Europe on the bike, so in a race. So the time that you actually have to take to learn how the bunch moves and, you know, get around the most efficiently way possible, I'm already feeling it in this race already, that, you know, I'm racing further up the front of the bunch with way less energy this time. So yeah, there's definitely a learning curve, and you just don't get that on the other side of the world. You know, I'd race in amateurs with 50 guys and I'd be the strongest by far, so I could just ride wherever I wanted. If there was a split in a crosswind section, I could just bridge across. It's actually, you know, it has hampered my development because I haven't learnt the race smarts, and it's taken a long time this year to learn them.
What's the plan today?
I think the plan today is breakaway. I think guys are going to be trying to get satellite riders up the road, and if I can sneak into a move without using too much energy, that's great. Otherwise, I think Remco's after a stage win.
So Dan, that was Jay Vine, well, telling us that life as a third year pro he is now, Alpecin Phoenix, it's not all glamour. And in fact, his idea of a celebration, until a couple of days ago anyway, was a €4 cappuccino. He lives in Andorra, doesn't he? Does he live in Andorra?
I think he's moved to Andorra. But he said he moved to Girona the other day. I saw in a piece, but I mean, yeah.
Okay. Both places probably, you know where. Is that the going rate for cappuccino in Girona and Andorra, €4?
Not really, no. It's more Spanish prices. But yeah, I mean, like maybe he's talking about being at a stage race, you know, because you don't really get a... That's the problem with being at a stage mid-tour. You don't have a chance to celebrate because it's right back at it the next day.
I mean, it was interesting him talking about his bonuses and how important they were. I mean, the other day he paid tribute to his wife and he talked about how they'd sort of sold up in Australia and they'd move to Europe to pursue this dream. I was a little bit surprised to hear him sort of suggest that he was still on quite a low salary, because he did actually sign a contract extension in August 2021. So this is his second contract now with Alpecin Phoenix. I would have thought the second one would have been considerably more valuable than the first one. He's contracted to that team now until 2023, but he's certainly someone who, well, he's on a fast track, isn't he, Dan? And I think, well, we heard him there talk about his sort of GC ambitions in the future and what he's already improved in the last year. I think that the consensus in the World Tour will be that this is a guy who can ultimately become a real GC contender, wouldn't you agree?
It depends. I mean, he doesn't really fit the typical GC rider morphology, as far even a climber's morphology. He's a bigger guy. He's obviously quite well built, and yeah, it's very different doing riding a Grand Tour the way he's riding. And he's obviously got the advantage of, obviously, he's prepared his whole season around this race, and a lot of the guys. But as you say, he won the Amstel of the GC group the other day, so he's clearly climbing. He's one of, if not the best climber in the race at the moment. So, but it also, I mean, the pressure of being a team leader and a GC rider, it's completely different. And having the mental side of racing day in, day out. And it isn't just that, it's because obviously with his background, that's why it's when he's obviously earned his contract through racing on Zwift, and he's clearly got some kind of peloton skills to be able to win two stages of the Vuelta. But you need to be able to really do it all as a GC rider. And obviously I didn't personally start riding GC and Grand Tours till I was, yeah, older than Jay Vine is now. So it is something that he can definitely learn in the right environment. And perhaps, I mean, we don't know the ins and outs of his contract at all, because it's obviously something that's not really spoken of in pro cycling, but he's maybe hinting at a pay rise or one of the bigger teams to come hunting for him with those comments about the financial situation.
I mean, you sort of cracked that, as you say, Dan, later in your career. How difficult was that process of sort of switching your mindset, and also, I guess, to a certain extent, you switched things in your training and your preparation as well to become more of a GC rider?
Yeah, we moved to Andorra and suddenly I became a real Grand Tour climber. Yeah, it's just that climbing day in, day out, it's a different type of training. You need to take away that one-off performance, that one-off explosiveness to be able to build on the stamina that you need to perform over 3 weeks. But it's more the mental challenge as well of that consistency and just keeping concentrated day in, day, every kilometre for 3,000 kilometres. So it's something I was still working at towards the end of my career, because even tactically, you cannot afford to make any mistake during a Grand Tour. If not, it can be costly. And that stress and concentration that's required, it's something that's not really understood well outside of the sport. And even within the sport, unless you've tried to ride a Grand Tour GC, it's really a challenge that it's difficult to comprehend.
I mean, did you feel that it sort of spilled over into your everyday life as well? I mean, people talk about Grand Tour riders being on a knife edge the whole time, the whole year, in fact, because everything you do, whether it's 2 months out, 3 months out, 4 months out, it feeds in, has an effect on those. Well, let's face it, there are only three choices as far as big goals are concerned in the year. It's either the Giro, either the Tour, or the Vuelta. And you can reset if something goes wrong. You can say, okay, I'm not going to do the Tour now, I'm going to do the Vuelta. But there's so much riding on every moment, really, every day, every week. Did you find that sort of stress spilled over into your everyday life?
I think it's just the normal stress of being a pro cyclist. You do worry about getting sick all the time, or... yeah, worry about if not going out because it's pouring rain or even snowing in my situation in Andorra, if that's going to cost you later down the line. It's that, I think, anxiety almost is a good way of putting it. It is a daily, it's a 24/7 job. Even though you only spend, obviously, between 2 and 6 hours a day on the bike, you are thinking about those objectives all year round, 365, like, every day, 24/7. So but it's also easy, well, not easy, but very important to take away that stress and try and, I think that's what beats up a lot of riders. That's where you see riders often who have one successful Grand Tour and suddenly they crumble. They don't perform again and they keep, I mean, Enric Mas, this is his first really good Grand Tour he's been there or thereabouts, but it's the first time we've really seen him at the heights that he was. When was the last Grand Tour that he was?
He was on the podium last year.
He was on the podium.
Yeah, he was second last year. But okay. Yeah, he's had a few. He's had a sort of checkered recent past in Grand Tours. Yeah, I mean, I was just wondering, Dan. You know, we were talking about finances and being pragmatic. It can also be a pragmatic choice, can't it? Someone in Jay Vine's position, he can be a very effective stage hunter for the next few years, but financially that might not be as rewarding as being someone who sells themselves and is sold probably by their agent as someone who could potentially crack a top five in Grand Tours.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's there's being a GC rider in a Grand Tour is obviously, it just adds on, yeah, so much to your value. I'm not even sure why. Even as a classics rider, it's I think people see it almost as a risk, whereas if you're a Grand Tour rider, it's showing that strength over 3 weeks that can, yeah, it can really, the teams pay for that. It's every team almost needs its Grand Tour riders, and one, two, or three of them now. So if you can prove that you can sustain the effort over 3 weeks, yeah, your contract value goes up and up. And that's why so many riders focus on the Tour de France. It's worth risking going all in for the Tour de France and trying to get a top 10. Because if you can make it into that top 10, then, yeah, your value in the eyes of the cycling teams, it just goes up.
Well, Dan, we're talking about GC and Jay Vine and whether that's something that is on his horizon. Let's now switch our focus and talk about the GC. Before we do, we haven't had a dose of the trademark Primoz Roglic loquacity for a few days. Loquaciousness, loquacity, not sure which. So let's do that now. Let's have our first instalment for a few days of the Daily Rog. Take it away, Rob, first.
El Diario Roglic.
Asturias, just expecting, rampas at the end, but hoping to have the legs to come over them. Waiting to get my legs. We have to see how the race will develop. Definitely, it will be a hard start from the very starting uphill. And yeah, then we have to see how it goes. And yeah, anyway, at the end, hoping to be there with the fastest guys.
So there was Primoz Roglic this morning, as expansive as ever. And then, well, we're introducing a new feature for as long as this Vuelta a España is a bit of a head-to-head battle between Remco Evenepoel and Primoz Roglic. Different interview styles, different sort of countenance at the moment. Remco Evenepoel is very sprightly, very exuberant. And let's have our first ever Daily Remco. Let's hear from him this morning.
El Diario Remco. The Daily Remco.
I expect also a team like Movistar, they are really known for park courses like this, so I hope they put a hard pace already on the climbs before, that it's better than having a walk in the park towards the last climb, but it's never going to be a walk in the park on the stage like today.
Okay, you seem remarkably relaxed, as though you're enjoying this whole experience.
I think it's a jersey.
You think it's a jersey?
Yeah.
So, Dan, nothing between Primoz Roglic and Remco Evenepoel today. I mean, I've jotted a few notes down, sort of who had a good day, who had a bad day. I've got Remco and Roglic both having a good day today, as well as Carlos Rodriguez, Enric Mas, and Simon Yates. I've also got Theo Gegenhardt as having a good day. Would you agree with all of those?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Remco is obviously going to be the happier. He's one day closer to that time trial. I mean, that time trial the day after the rest day is going to be crucial, because if he has a good day there, he can extend his lead. And yeah, I'd agree that there wasn't that much movement considering the start and finish, but it all adds up, and it's really a gauge of form. Generally in a Grand Tour, you're not going to see guys improving massively, although obviously Roglic can change that because he claims not to have trained much since the Tour, so we can see him improving before Madrid. But other than that, I think normally the status quo that's established in this first week will continue on the subsequent mountain stages. So it's but I think what is exciting is to see the number of teams with teammates, with multiple riders in that top 10, top 15, who can now go on, like, be aggressive and put pressure on Remco. So that's definitely something they would have been worried about on these types of days, today and tomorrow, that if teams really want to go on the break early, they don't really have a quick step, perhaps don't have the team to really control the race.
I was a little bit worried about Roglic today. Well, this morning when he talked about just trying to be with the best guys, that sounded like quite a defensive statement from him. Again, you can't read too much into what Primoz Roglic says, not least because he doesn't really say very much. But he was quite a long way back in that group. The sort of hostilities really started with about 5K to go, when the final climb became really steep. But until that point, it was relatively big, that group, and Primoz Roglic was sort of in the belly of it. Which he wasn't on Remco's shoulder. He didn't look primed for an attack, and I was slightly concerned that he wasn't on a good day. But it's a sort of gritty performance from Roglic at this point, isn't it? He's holding on, I think, in the hope and expectation maybe that he is going to get better in this Vuelta a España.
Yeah, of course, that would be the hope for him. And obviously, he still finished right up there with Remco, put time into the other contenders. So yeah, he's not badly placed. He's just probably hoping to get to the rest day, and then he can reset and really come out fighting in the final. Well, it's still 2 weeks to go, isn't it?
It is indeed, Dan. And just a couple of the other names we mentioned, Enric Mas. I mean, it was the same. It was an action replay, really, of what we saw the other day from Enric Mas, just sticking to Remco's wheel and trying to come round him in the last 500 metres, which I'm sure went down like a lead balloon. And Simon Yates as well. Similar to Roglic, I think he probably feels that he can get better, and he will hope that Remco weakens, and he's still very much in the fight, isn't he? I know he's your tip to win. Is he still your tip to win this Vuelta a España?
I think with the time trial coming up now and how his form is going, maybe I want to change my tip, you know. But yeah, I expected him to come out swinging in this first week. The way his condition was coming into the Vuelta, I really thought that he would he'll be there. But he's got experience. He's playing the long game, but obviously he's not he just doesn't quite have the same climbing lengths as Remco, Roglic and Mass at the moment. So, but it's, as you said, this Vuelta can be really unpredictable because potentially we're going to have a Remco Evenepoel with a large lead after the time trial and not the strongest team. So who knows what can happen.
Dan, it was a really bad day today for Pavel Sivakov, who's looked very good so far in the Vuelta a España, and that weakens Ineos' hand considerably. Teo Gegenhardt, as we said, had a pretty good day. He limited his losses, and Carlos Rodriguez was one of the stars of the show. He's only 1 minute and 47 seconds down on general classification. He's now in fourth place, and there'll be a lot of excitement here in Spain about that performance, I'm sure. But it's been a mixed bag, hasn't it, for Ineos? Carapaz again lost, he lost more time today, and I think you can say definitively that he's not going to win the Vuelta a España or even really be a huge factor in the general classification. But how do you see them now with, with Rodriguez fourth, Teo in fifth, just behind, just a few seconds behind Carlos Rodriguez, and then Carapaz and Sivakov now well down the general classification?
Yeah, I think obviously Carapaz was their go-to going into the race. He's the one that they would have expected to be aggressive. Teo, he's not one that's going to be aggressive in the mountains and take back time on the guys. So, and Carlos Rodriguez, I mean, he's a young rider. He's his first Grand Tour, I think. So he's he's a big unknown. Obviously, it doesn't mean anything now to be 21 years old and it's your first Grand Tour, because we've seen so many young guys win Grand Tours at that age lately. They have to be aggressive if they want to get something out of this race now. Or did they switch their tactics to stage hunting? That's the big question.
Well, as Seb Piquet, the voice of Race Radio, always says on the cycling podcast, chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. We have had a bit of a mishap, a crash. Yesterday, I joined you from a place called Fistierna, and yesterday's guest and I, Nico Van Looy, we joked about the fact that the origin of the name, well, it was a cistern, and it was raining pretty heavily. It's also raining pretty heavily in La Massana in Andorra, so much so that Dan Martin's basement has been flooded, causing him to, he's DNF'd on this podcast. Poor old Dan. He's, as we speak, down in the basement with a shovel or some other implement, trying to clear the water away. So hopefully we'll see him again we'll hear from him again at another point later in the Vuelta. But I have been joined again by Nico Van Looy, who did join us last night, formerly of Meta 2000, Las Provincias, Ciclo 21, and, yesterday we talked a lot about Spanish cycling, we talked a lot about Juan Ayuso, and we also talked about Sky's prodigy, Carlos Rodriguez. And Nico, it was a pretty good day for Carlos in particular, wasn't it?
Yeah, impressive day, wasn't it? He was with the best guys till the very end. He only lost a couple of seconds today. I think it was 13 at the end, so 13 seconds. So I think in that battle between him himself and Ayuso, he's now winning the race of the Spanish heiress of the golden generation, which is ending now with Valverde's last Vuelta. So I guess it's a big day for him also, because now he's more or less the leader of Team Ineos with Teo, of course. But he's gaining that status inside the team, which will be very important for him, I guess, also in this Vuelta, but also for the future.
Well, Nico, we're going to talk about Alejandro Valverde in tonight's instalment of this.
El ritmo de la Vuelta. The rhythm of the Vuelta.
This is El Ritmo de la Vuelta, our daily deep dive into a vortex of cheesy pop music and vintage Vuelta action, remembering the official songs of the race and the additions to which they provided the soundtrack. Nico, tonight we're going back to 2009. The song is Merezco by Zahara. The Andalusian singer-songwriter, also known as Maria Zahara Gordilla Campos. She was 26 when the song was recorded and then released on her first studio album, the catchily titled La Fabulosa Historia de la Chica que Perdió el Avión, the fabulous story of the girl who missed the plane. Fabulous, fabulous title indeed. Now, Nico, the 2009 Vuelta was significant, well, for our other guest tonight's debut in the Vuelta, but it was also the last Vuelta for what, Nico? Something quite significant in the Vuelta and in the general classification. What was it, the last time we saw something? The Mayotte.
Oh, the golden one.
The golden jersey, which I quite liked. Yeah. Did you, Nico? I thought it was quite fetching.
It was one of those bets that the Vuelta did in the past to be different than the Tour de France. Instead of being the yellow jersey, having that golden jersey. And I think it was a nice way of having the yellow color somehow, but in a different way. But I think because of all what the red means in Spain, it's the national football team color as well, I think this one, the red one, is the one that's going to be for many, many years to come.
I would agree with you. That year's race, the 2009 race, started in Assen in the Netherlands, which made it only the second foreign Gran Salida in the Vuelta's history, the first having been from Lisbon in 1997. Fabian Cancellara took the first golden jersey in the Netherlands and wore it for much of the first week until... Who, Nico, can you remember, took it on the Alto de Aitana, not too far from where you are now, on stage 8? Can you remember? Took it for one day?
I'd say it was Cad Evans?
Cad Evans, exactly. Evans himself was dislodged the very next day when Alejandro Valverde dropped him on the Zorrete de Cati climb near Alicante. Valverde even racing the Vuelta was seen by some as an act of defiance, the Italian Olympic Committee having banned him from competing within their borders in April due to DNA evidence linking him to Operación Puerto. The UCI's president, Pat McQuaid, had said in response to those sanctions, "This is, for the moment, an Italian affair under Italian law. The UCI will have to wait until the process finishes to see how we can proceed." Indeed, the following May, the Court of Arbitration for Sport would agree that Valverde's ban should be extended to the rest of the world as per a case brought by the UCI and WADA. Having taken the lead at the 2009 Vuelta, Valverde seemed impervious to any sense of impending doom, but was pushed all the way by Samuel Sanchez, who drew within a minute of El Bala in the penultimate day time trial. Sanchez, who incidentally has a statue dedicated to him in his native Oviedo, where we were this morning. Like Woody Allen, I should add. He's got a statue in Oviedo as well. I saw that this morning. I saw Samuel Sanchez today. He was from Oviedo and he was working for Spanish TV today. Was he not, Nico?
Yeah, he was. He was giving his insight in the after stage program on the Spanish TV, yeah.
Now, we could talk for hours about Alejandro Valverde and his legacy and the difference between the way he's received and the way he's regarded in Spain versus the rest of the world. That was just a reminder to me. I'd forgotten just how contentious the circumstances around that Vuelta win were. I mean, that was his only Grand Tour victory, and it came at the moment where, well, the pro Alejandro Valverde's and those who were of the firm opinion that he shouldn't be allowed to race. They were really, well, that sort of division was really opening up at that point. But it is curious, isn't it, Nico? I mean, today at the start, he got a fantastic ovation. He gets a fantastic ovation every day. He's still regarded as a bit of a home hero. Yet, there are plenty of people who believe, perhaps justifiably, legitimately, that he should never really have been forgiven because he never really showed much contrition himself for what occurred in 2006 and before that.
Yeah, but the thing here is, as many of the other riders trapped in the Operación Puerto back in the days, he never tested positive on any drug test. He was found guilty on evidence, and there was plenty of evidence that he was working with Eufemiano, Fuentes, and all that stuff. But he always claimed that he never took any forbidden substance. I mean,
the evidence was pretty clear and pretty explicit DNA about him having used forbidden methods at that time.
Yes, of course. But if he's sticking to his story, and regardless of the evidence, and I can understand the people that still loves him, and I can understand the people that hate him. But in the meanwhile, he came back from that period, and he kept winning till this very season. So I'm trying not to be. I like him. I have to be honest. I like the guy. I like him. I've enjoyed all these years watching him in the races, speaking with him. I really like the guy, so I can't be neutral on this.
Yeah, I think that does muddy the waters, particularly when you speak to people who have ridden with him in the peloton. I was curious to get Dan's view on this because Dan spent many years in the peloton competing for the same races as Valverde, and what you often hear from his contemporaries is that he's a nice guy, and he's someone who has time for everyone. He's not arrogant in the way he behaves in the peloton or indeed with the media, and that makes judgments a little bit more sort of I suppose ambivalent about him, but it is a tricky one, and that's, I suppose, well, we will discuss this further later on in the world, particularly as the sort of sentimental tributes and the homages, they ramp up, which I'm sure they will, particularly in a few days when we go down to Murcia and his region.
Yeah, let me just add to that. I mean, I firmly believe he had to be I think it was 2 years his sanction, wasn't it? I think that was fair enough because there was evidence enough that to do that, of course. But if we believe that sanctions are made to make riders or sportsmen reflect on what they've done, he had the right to come back. And as you said, the image of him inside the peloton, I think the best image that you can that reflects that is when he won his world title. I think there was no one there. I mean, rivals in the peloton that wasn't happy for him. Even the second guy, the guy who came second, was somehow happy for him. So I think that really summarized the Valverde hype in the peloton.
Nico, let's talk now about another rider at this Vuelta a España who I think everyone would agree is moving towards the twilight of his career, and he's not having the best Vuelta a España. So it's time for today's Encuentro del Día. Take it away, Rob Hatch.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Chris Froome's Vuelta a España didn't start in the way he had wanted. Well, you can trace his difficulties at this Vuelta a España back to the Tour de France, in fact, when he tested positive for COVID and had to pull out of the race in Lourdes. This morning I spoke to him about those struggles and, well, what he hopes for from the rest of the race.
Well, Chris, am I right in thinking that your Vuelta started badly, more or less? Does that sort of set the tone a little bit?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. So, I was only symptomatic for probably best part of 10 days, but it definitely affected my preparation coming into the Vuelta a España. When I got back on the bike again after the symptoms had cleared, I just felt I had nothing. I just really struggling to hit the numbers that I needed to hit, and dealing with a lot of fatigue as well, just residual fatigue. So it definitely affected my preparation coming in here. I knew that coming into this Vuelta, I'd have to ride into it, take the first week almost looking at it as training, and hoping that the second half of the Vuelta, I'll start to find my legs. So still waiting to see if that's going to be the case. But for now, just getting through the stages as best I can, and helping the team with their goals along the way.
a lot of guys who've had COVID have talked about this, and they've described different feelings and different effects on their kind of physiology. I mean, do you still feel that there's a bit of it there, and how does it manifest itself? Is it, you see it in your heart rate, do you see it in your watts, do you see it in, well, just the way you feel after stages?
There's definitely been some very strange heart rate readings for me that I've been keeping an eye on. going higher than I would have seen previously. It's something we're monitoring closely, and it seems to have settled now into a more predictable range. But given obviously the body's just fought quite a hard virus, I think it's safe to say at the moment it's worth just not pulling out all the stops and going too deep just yet, until the body's feeling better.
And you wanted this to be, well, this was a big goal for you, wasn't it, Chris, the welter?
It was, yeah. I mean, it was my big goal of the season, actually. I was really hoping, as was the case, to build through the tour, which I felt was on track. But, it really did derail me a little bit coming into this welter.
So, with your crystal ball out, what do you think is going to happen in your welter over the next 10 days or so? What's the best case scenario anyway?
Best case scenario is that get through the next couple of days to the rest day and start feeling better in the second part of the race and get more involved in the breakaways, maybe go stage hunting. But I'm going to have to play that one by ear. As it is at the moment, that's just not possible. So I'm helping my teammates as best I can and helping the team to target individual stages.
And just lastly, Chris, I mean, you've had so many setbacks the last couple of years, so many things to deal with. I mean, how is morale?
Yeah, good. I mean, this year I got a really big boost from seeing where I could get to with the Tour de France. I feel as if I've made a lot of progress, and that's not going to go away for the next season. So I'm going to be able to build on that now over the winter and hopefully start the year off in a better way.
Nico, it's tough, isn't it, not to sympathise with Chris Froome to a certain degree. Every time he seems to see some light at the end of the tunnel, then the kind of clouds will close in again, and, well, he has to deal with more adversity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's impossible not to love Chris Froome for all what he has been in cycling, for how he has treated all of us during his best years, or how he has always been with the fans, and especially now, speaking about the Vuelta a España, all what he has given to the Vuelta a España. We can't forget, we never should forget, that when he was winning one tour after the other, where many, many other riders would say, okay, my year is done, I've done all my homework, I can go and have a rest, he always committed to the Vuelta a España, he always came to the Vuelta a España and fought for the Vuelta a España to the very end. So I think it's pretty unfair with him, all what happened since that nasty crash some years ago, because his legacy, I really hope he can win a stage this year in the Vuelta, or have a good year next year, which might be his final year. I don't know. But I really wouldn't like him to have this 3-4 final years without any good moment, let's say. So, like, he's been doing 3-4 more years too much in his career. I think he deserves one last big moment, one last dance. Let's put it that way.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Vuelta a España. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. You can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. Now, occasionally, Science in Sport run even more generous discounts than the Cycling Podcast one. And I think if you're in the UK at the moment to mark the British Bank Holiday weekend, there's 30% off everything. But at all other times, SISCP25 will give you 25% off. So you can fuel for your ride, which is something I'm preparing to do, because tomorrow, while Daniel's over there in Spain working hard, I'm going for a bike ride, which has been planned by a friend of mine. It's not far short of 120 kilometers, and of the five or six of us, I suspect that I may well be the first one to show signs of wear and tear, because they're all pretty fast riders. So I want to make sure that I'm well fueled up and I don't run out of energy all of a sudden. So I'm getting my Science in Sport bidons ready. I'm going to take Beta Fuel to keep myself topped up with carbohydrate through the ride. I'll take a couple of energy gels, and I'll perhaps take a caffeine gel for the end of the ride. We are actually stopping for a proper lunch stop halfway round, so we'll get some real food as well, but I want to make sure that I keep my energy levels consistent through the ride. So the gels and the energy bakes will come in very handy. Only strawberry flavor left in my little stash of Science in Sport products. The tiramisu no longer on the website, almost as if it was a mirage, but I'm sure they'll be back at some point. At least I hope so. Anyway, back to Spain. I'll update you on my bike ride tomorrow.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
So, Nico, last night, la cena de ayer, I had some pote asturiano de Berzas. You ever had that before? It's, what is it, a cabbage, kind of cabbage soup with, again, unidentified pieces of meat in, which, again, I tried to avoid.
I would never have that at night, but yeah, I've tasted that in the past.
You would never have it at night? Why not?
Too heavy for me, I think. I like more like light suppers, and when I have to eat properly, I do it, en nuestra comida, almuerzo.
You southern softies down there, yeah, on the Costa Blanca.
Yeah.
We also had a lovely bottle of Mencia from Bierzo, which was outstanding. But Nico, moving on to tomorrow. We're still in Asturias, are we not? And it falls to you to tell us what we've got coming on this, well, the second half of this double header in the Asturian mountains.
First of all, the weather forecast is predicting sun and a hot day. So that would be the first thing to note on an Asturian stage. The stage itself starts in Villaviciosa, more or less on the sea level, and it ends in Les Praeres Nava. That's the second time this summit will be in the Vuelta a España. First time was back in 2018. And then Simon Yates won there and took his leadership to the very end of the Vuelta. So statistically, the guy who comes out from Les Praeres Nava as the leader is the guy that wins the Vuelta a España at the end. Before arriving there, we have 171 kilometers with another four climbs, first category climb, second category climb, and three category climbs. So, like today, a stage with no moment to rest, a stage where anything can happen, actually, and a stage where we will see the best guys fighting for the finish in a very, very, very steep and short final climb.
It does look a lot like today's profile, doesn't it, Nico? Similar stage.
Yeah, it's a typical Asturian stage. The only thing I think today's last summit was a little bit harder in terms of distance. It was a longer climb. This one is more typical La Vuelta style in the last years, like a big wall at the end. There's people who love it, people who doesn't like it, but it's that kind of mountain finish.
Just incidentally, I alluded to this earlier, but Les Praieres, the climb, was discovered apparently when Javier Nguyen went to a cider festival in Nava, which is the town, I think it's the town at the bottom of the climb, isn't it, Nico? And he got talking, I think, to some members of the local cycling club, the Navastur cycling club, and it sure enough did feature in the race in 2018. There were quite a number of riders there in that edition, and particularly that day you mentioned when Simon Yates won, who will also be riding tomorrow. Enric Mas was there, Alejandro Valverde, Rigoberto Urán, they were all competing for victory. Superman Lopez, who's kept a very low profile, has been pretty disappointing in this Vuelta a España so far, but they will all be familiar with the climb. I'm not sure, I haven't heard too much about what state the road is in, because last time, certainly the last couple 100 meters were kind of gravel, compacted gravel, and I'm not sure what, if any, effect that had on the racing itself, but as you said, Nico, it was certainly a climb that Simon Yates enjoyed last time. Nico, just looking ahead, have you revised your view of Remco Evenepoel at all? I know you were, I think you were in the pro Remco camp before the Vuelta a España, or after the first stage when we got together with Dan Martin then. Are you more and more confident of his ability and his chances in this Vuelta a España?
Well, yeah, as long as he's the leader and there's each day there's one day less to arrive to Madrid, you have to be more confident, aren't you? But I think if he gets a good stage tomorrow, like he did today, he doesn't lose time with the big guys in the last climb, and keeping in mind that the next stage on Tuesday will be a time trial, 30-kilometer time trial, he should win time over Enric there,
and even Roglic. I think he'll take a little bit of time off Roglic.
Yeah, that's what I want to. That's what I doubt the most, but I think he should win sometime over Roglic. I think the big answer will be that time trial. If he gets over that time trial, still in the lead, and he gets over Sierra Nevada I think it's 2 or 3 days later, then he will have very big chances to win the Vuelta a España.
Well, Nico, we'll see tomorrow how he gets on. That just about concludes tonight's entertainment. There have been floods, there have been stoppages, there's been all sorts of adversity to deal with, but we have dealt with it, I think, and I hope. I did promise yesterday that we would hear from Remco Evenepoel's babysitter, one-time babysitter, who also happens to be his masseur or his soigneur at Quickstep. A bit of a coincidence, actually. He wasn't brought to the team by Remco, but this gentleman has known the Evenepoel family for many, many years, as we're about to find out. His name is David Hermans. And, well, he will play us out tonight. But in the meantime, Nico, I'm going to thank you for stepping in when I had to make a tactical substitution halfway through the episode. And we will be hearing from you and possibly seeing you in Alicante next week. So thank you, Nico, and have a lovely evening.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
I know him already when he's born. His parents is good friends of me. His mother and his father already more than 20 years. So I see all the changes from footballist to cyclist, and yeah, with the results we see it now. When he was 1 year old, he was sometimes in my house for sleep. When the parents going to a party, then he was with me and my wife. He was always a special child. I have watching sometimes in the football when he play in PS3 and Anderlecht.
He played left back. Was he fast or strong or skillful?
Fast and strong.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when his father told you, or you heard, that he was starting to race his bicycle, can you remember what you thought?
Yeah. On an evening, he called me for say, yeah, listen now. He stopped with football, and he want to go cycling. And I say, yes, okay, we will do it. And but he said to me, this day he take my bike and he make a loop from 80 kilometer with an average of 30. So I say directly, yeah, maybe start with cycling directly, because he have a special
motor.
Yeah, special motor.
And now you are his masseur. I hear that on the massage table he enjoys music.
Sometimes it's hardcore music.
Hardcore rap, hardcore rock, hardcore dance music, what kind?
Hardcore dance music, yeah. Or like Tomorrowland in Belgium, he liked it also.
Do you worry about Remco sometimes because of all of the pressure and all of the attention?
Yeah, for him it's not so easy. Yeah. It's when he come outside, when he go to the pub, when he go to the shop, it's always everybody wants the picture and signature. So for him it's not so easy, but it's okay it's okay for the moment.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.